Hello, welcome to Conversations. My name is Kayleen Welsh, and I am your host for this week's episode. And I'm really pleased to have in the studio here with me Clayton Burke. Clayton Burke is the manager, the director, the DOT representative for the project in Lansing on rebuilding the Black Hawk Bridge. And so we met about, I realized it was just a little, not quite a year ago. And at that time, there were a few things starting to happen with the bridge, and there's been a lot that's gone on since then. And it just feels as we're coming into July and summer, we should talk a little bit about what's next, what's happened and what's next. So I'm glad you're here, Clayton. Thanks a lot for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, for sure. Well, a lot has happened since we talked the last time. So maybe we should start with a little bit of a refresher of what all has gone on in the last year.
It's been an incredible year. We've made a ton of progress, and it's interesting to look back because it doesn't feel like it's been a year. I feel like I was just here not too long ago talking about the demolition and explaining a little bit about, you know, how we came to that situation, how we were handling it, and how we really, you know, we wanted to move forward and get the new bridge built.
Yeah, and at that time it was kind of drastic news to hear that the old bridge had to come down before we could get really going on the new one. And so it was an interesting time at that point when we talked last July, because it was not very, I guess it took a little while to pull together all the pieces, but there was some community response at the time of like, oh my God, how come this had to happen this way, and what are we doing? And so any comment on that? You know, I don't know what to even say about that, but it feels like the mood has kind of shifted as far as the city. The people have been very supportive of the progress so far, of what's gone on, about how all this is coming together. Maybe a little bit fallout back then, but it's all switched around, it feels like, since then. Would that be true?
Yeah, I'd say at the very beginning, when we first announced the change in the project to the demolition of the existing bridge first, I wouldn't say there's any animosity towards anyone in particular. There's just general frustration with, you know, nobody likes change, and we were frustrated with it too. We wanted to stay on track and keep building the bridge the way we were supposed to build it. And so this change was, it was just a big hurdle for everyone to get over. And in the beginning, there was a lot of discussion on how it should be handled and what we should do to help support the people that this was going to affect. And that ultimately resulted in the car ferry, which was quite the adventure as well.
Oh, which has been a fabulous addition, and I think, again, worked out way better than anybody ever really anticipated. It sounded good at the time, but, you know, again, there's always those voices that go, oh, I don't know how they're going to do that, or, you know, that isn't going to work for me, or whatever. But it seems like it's been a well-received and very important piece of this bridge building process for the community of Lansing. It feels to me like it's been one of those pieces that's kept Lansing alive.
Absolutely. And I still want to recognize it's not the ideal solution for most people, but I think there is, I always like to look at the silver linings. Growing up, my mom always told me, you know, she taught me to look at the positive sides of things, and she always said, you can't roller skate in a buffalo herd, but you can be happy if you want to.
Okay.
And so there's this challenge, this thing we all face together. And obviously it'd be better if there's just a bridge there, but we now have this shared experience that we're all having together with the car ferry. I ride it, the entire community rides it, and it brings people back and forth and still maintains that connection between family and work and critical services across the river and between Iowa and Wisconsin. So it can be fun. It's like you said, it's a nice relaxing ride across the river. You get to see the new bridge being built as you travel under it. And we have a wonderful crew. I've really enjoyed the people that have stood up and taken on the challenge of operating the ferry. And the deckhands, they're very sociable and they're fun to talk to.
Totally agree. Yeah. You know, it started out with the Cassville Ferry, and I just want to put in a plug for them, because if anybody's down around Cassville, might as well take their ferry and go across, because they started this off for us in a very good way, I think. You know, yeah. They were reliable, they were dependable, they were, again, pleasant and helpful, and it was kind of sad to see them go. And yet we've had this new ferry come in, this bright yellow, stands out in the river very clearly, this bright yellow ferry. And that, again, can carry people across. And, I suppose at some point we want to give people a lot of details around the ferry because, you know, with the 4th of July weekend coming up, we have seen it gotten busier for the summer. And so, and one of the things that I want to go back to just a minute about what you said is, you know, even this part where we had to, where we realized that we had to take the old bridge down. Part of this, it just seems like, has been, you know, that ability to flow with whatever does happen. And so, you know, again, the Casper ferry we got, then it had to go. You know, there's been busier traffic for the ferry now as summer has come on. So, but every step along the way, then, when there's been something come up like that, you guys have found an option that seems to be helpful or to work. So I'm impressed and grateful for the flexibility that you guys have been able to show and the problem-solving skills. You know, you're able to look at a situation and go, oh, boy, okay, what are we going to do with that? And then come up with some plan.
Absolutely. And none of it's been necessarily me. So it's...
Okay.
The best thing I have done for this project is to put together the team of people that are working on it. And after that, it's all been them. We have an incredible group of people that know how to solve problems. They have the experience and the know-how. When something like the existing bridge moving comes up, the next day they were working on solutions and they knew what could be done. And then our contractor, Kramer North America, has the same experience and the same level of dedication to providing viable options to maintain the service that we're here to provide. So it really was a great group effort, and we worked together to come up with those solutions and implement them. And we couldn't have done it without Kramer, and Kramer couldn't have done it without, you know, our team working together to come up with those repairs and the solutions that we did.
Well, it's been a nice team effort. You know, I've been very appreciative, too, of Kramer. I mean, it's just been pretty phenomenal to me to watch this whole process all along. And, again, their dedication, their workers are out there all the time. Just so many pieces along the way that feel like, thank you so much for your skills and dedication and problem-solving skills. Even I think about the engineering for this. As I've, you know, sat in on a couple of these bridge talks in Lansing at the library, which are a very lovely way to keep informed of what's going on with the bridge. But some of the technical discussion that happens there just kind of goes like, oh, my goodness, how do these people even figure out how to do that kind of stuff? So I'm grateful for the engineering skills and the problem-solving skills and the flexibility that you guys have brought to this whole project, you and your team.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that, it all starts with a clear vision of what our purpose is. And our director, our governor, they provide that very clear vision for what we do, and it's very customer focused. So we're looking at the services we provide and maintaining that mobility. So as soon as we decided that we had to lose the crossing, it became imperative. Well, our purpose is to provide that mobility for our customers. And so it was easy for us to say, well, we can't just accept that we're losing the crossing. We have to provide some alternate service for the communities and the travelers and our customers. So that I really appreciate having that clear vision and those clear objectives, and that helps us provide direction for the rest of the team and the group.
Well, I love that too, and I guess I got to say that I'm not so sure that I've always thought about the DOT that way. I mean, as far as customer service, or I mean, I guess I know that the projects that you guys take on are for the good of a community or an area, or to improve something. I don't know. I don't know that I recognized how positive of an experience it could be to have a project like this in a community.
Yeah, it's. I think a lot of people experience us through the motor vehicle, the DMV,
sure.
which is you know, there's the stereotypes of how the DMV is, but I think Wisconsin and Iowa have been making great improvements to some of that customer experience. Like I said, when we take a more customer-focused approach, we look at how we interact with people, and it's not just providing a minimum service. It's, well, what do people expect when they show up here? What are we actually providing? And a three-hour wait is not an expectation. That's not a good service to our customers. So I think they've been improving through the DMV, and then our social media presence. I think our social media manager, Pete Helmstead, has been doing just an incredible job for this project and other projects in the area. But for our project in particular, Pete does a great job of connecting with people and sharing information. So in the past, we didn't have Facebook, of course, and we didn't have public websites, but I don't think people, besides seeing orange signs and construction equipment, really knew what was going on with our projects.
Well, that makes sense. And I guess I appreciate just even a lot of the little touches along the ways that have engaged you guys with the community. But like even the big blow-up decoration on the bridge at Christmas time, you know, there's just so many little fun things that have really engaged this whole process with the community or into the community. All right, well, let's just go back for a minute here and do a little bit of a review of what has gone on since we talked a year ago. You know, first of all, the plan was is that we were going to have the old bridge in place. We realized it had to come down. So that came down, what was the implosion? Well, it closed in October, implosion in December.
Yep.
And that was a pretty big day. There was a lot of people that came to town that day to kind of keep an eye on things. And what is that kind of day like for you is one of my questions.
Yeah, I could not believe the number of people that showed up for the demolition of the existing bridge, the explosive demolition. To me, it goes back to the preparation. And Kramer always says, plan the work and work the plan. And that's what they do. So it was months and months of planning and meetings and working together to figure out exactly how we could attach the explosives to the bridge, how we could do that safely, who needed to be where. We worked with, I think, 21 law enforcement officers to come to town and help us close off streets so that people stayed a safe distance away from the bridge before it was demolished. And then it is, again, just the experience and the know-how of how to do these things made it seem easy. So I was very comfortable on demolition day because I knew we had gone through that plan so many times and that everyone knew exactly what they were doing. And I knew it was safe because safety was a priority in that plan. So, I mean, the thing I get most nervous about is safety and making sure that everybody goes home at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And thankfully, you know, that's exactly what happened. So,
well, the attention to detail required for that would probably, you know, kind of overwhelm me. I can't even imagine how much you have to pay attention to have that kind of a cohesive event come pull it off so safely. And you know, watching the bridge come down was certainly an interesting day for those people that were there to watch. And then the week afterwards, the kind of the skeleton pieces sticking up out of the water for a period of time was rather surreal, kind of ghostly or something. I don't know. That felt really
right.
Weird. But so then, you know, that was the next period of time, right, is cleaning up all that steel up out of the river and making the pathway safe again.
Yeah, continuing progress. So just to recap a little bit, we had to demolish the existing bridge because it was no longer safe for the contractor to work next to it and continue driving piling for the temporary supports that we needed for the new bridge.
Right.
And so dropping the existing bridge in the river created another obstruction, and it was very important to get that obstruction out of the river so that we could keep working on the new bridge. And so that was just something, again, Kramer came up with an excellent plan. They cut the bottom of the bridge in several places and left the top intact so that it was easy for them to come out and cut the top and then pick it out in pieces. And so it was very efficient. They got it done quickly, and then they were able to keep moving on with the project.
So, and that led us into winter. What was it like trying to keep up with things over the winter?
We got extremely lucky. So the winter is very mild, and while we had a few cold days that were, you know, it can be hard on the crews, to, and especially in morale, you have shorter days, less sunlight time, so shorter work days and cold temperatures, and then it takes longer to do everything in the winter because you always have to put on protective equipment, take it off, find the equipment that you're working with, and things don't like to run as well in the winter.
Sure.
So it just takes more time to do things. But we were still able to make progress and keep the project moving. It involves ice breaking, which is another topic.
Cute little ice cutters running around down the river.
Just constant moving around of tugs and little, even the little red tug that everybody's seen out there. But it's expensive. It costs gas, it costs time, and but to keep the project moving, we had to, that's just part of the process to get it. It comes down to, again, our objectives. So after we lost the existing bridge, at first we didn't care as much about how long it took to build the new bridge, as long as we had a crossing. And, you know, if problems came up, a small delay would be okay. But now that we lost the crossing and we were running a car ferry, now it is imperative to build that new bridge as fast as possible. So winter work was necessary to meet that objective.
Well, it's surprising to me to see how far things have come in this period of time, you know, how much has changed. And just recently, there was another big event with lifting this final center section into the bridge structure. So I guess before we even get into that a little bit, I want to talk about the spans that came out from either side of the river, from the Iowa side and the Wisconsin side. It's astounding to me as you look at those spans and how far they came out that they can hold themselves up like that. I don't know. Any comment or what would you say about building those spans or how that all works?
Yeah, it's both complicated and pretty simple. So what we had after the demolition and the cleanup, we had the concrete piers that stuck up out of the river. And those piers, as you build the, what we call a truss or the steel skeleton, whatever you want to call it, the frame of the bridge, you build it out in both directions because you're balancing that frame on top of that concrete pier in the middle of the river. So what we saw was the contractor building that frame out, and then they were able to hang out the section of the bridge over the river. We call that a cantilever, but it's just it means that it's hanging there without support. So it's just a basic kind of math equation. You have so much weight on one side, you can build that much weight out on the other side, and it balances like a teeter-totter. That's where the center section came in. So we were able to build the Wisconsin side longer than the Iowa side. And I know a lot of people noticed that, and there were a lot of questions to that. But that was simply because the portion of the bridge that we built on the Iowa side to the west of the pier was shorter than the balancing part of the truss on the Wisconsin side. So that part of the truss that we built towards Wisconsin was longer, which meant we could hang more steel out over the river because of that weight that was balancing it.
Oh, interesting. Okay, that's how that works. Well, you know, I guess I want to hear more about this, and I want to hear about the lifting of that center section. And right now, first, though, we're going to take a brief break. And I would just like to thank all the listeners for tuning in. This is WDRT-FM from Community Radio from Viroqua, Wisconsin. We're glad you're tuning in. The show is Conversations, and we're here every Thursday morning with a rotating host and a new guest to talk about something that's going on in the area of something of interest. So tune in every Thursday. Thanks for being here. All right, welcome back. We're here with Clayton Burke, and we're here talking about the Black Hawk Bridge or the new bridge in Lansing, whether it will be called the Black Hawk Bridge now or what will exactly happen. But we were just talking about some of the construction pieces and how the spans had been built from out from either side of the river, the cantilever, as you called it. And so it left a big gap for a little while. It was a very interesting picture to look at, as it just felt like in some ways this giant erector set, as this thing was being built across the river, this, you know, big pieces of steel up there with a big old hole in the middle. So, but not too long ago, when just a week ago or 2 weeks ago or so, Friday, it was a Friday day that that center section went up. So let's talk about that a little bit. It was built north of the marina. Is that kind of how it went in Lansing?
Yep. So the plan was always to build that center section next to the marina, next to that embankment that surrounds the marina on barges. And then that, I got a lot of questions about why would you do it like that? Why wouldn't you just build it piece by piece all the way out? And so the big challenge is working around the commercial navigation traffic, so the barges. We don't want to get out there. If we just built it piece by piece all the way across, we would have had to block navigational traffic much more often. And then building on a separate site allowed us to bring in more crews, and we could actually work in multiple places at once. So that sped up the construction process. But there's many benefits to doing it this way. But, you know, the big things are avoiding the commercial traffic and speeding up the building with multiple crews. And then we were able to construct it on the barges without really any problems that came up. It was very planned and methodical, and they used very advanced survey equipment to measure the different lengths of that section built on the barges so that they would know that when they lift that up in the air, it would fit right in that gap. Because that was a big concern, was everybody said, well, what if it doesn't fit?
I would imagine that would be a big stressor. I mean, because that's a piece that needs to be really measured well.
Yeah. So Kramer did an excellent job measuring. And the thing I talked about at the library event a lot was the fact that the bridge is actually adjustable. And we use all kinds of jacks to do that. And those jacks are just like your little hydraulic bottle jack. They're just like a big version of those. And they attach at the abutments or the ends where the steel truss touches down. There's concrete there, and we call that an abutment. And then the jacks that push off of those abutments can raise and lower the ends of the bridge.
I thought that was very fascinating to hear about. Yeah. And not only they can adjust up and down a little bit, but, and correct me if I got this wrong, but the Wisconsin side could even, like, move side to side a little bit if needed to be?
Yeah. So on the Wisconsin side, I found this really interesting too. They set it up so that it could move back and forth across the river several inches, and that allows them to open up that opening, yes, several inches so that it's wider, and you can slide that center section up, and then you can push it back closed until the holes align in the connecting plates.
Wow. That seems like so exact of a science. Amazing, really.
Yeah, and it's another aspect. You know, when I was in college, a lot of my professors would always say, keep it simple. And they'd add another word to that. But
yeah, right. I've heard that one. Uh-huh. Kiss.
But, yeah, exactly. But it seems really complicated, but the premise is actually pretty simple. You have a weight of the bridge, and then you have a size of a jack, and whether they're 500-ton jacks. You need this many 500-ton jacks because the bridge weighs this much. And then you just simply operate the jacks, and if you put the dial to this pressure, it goes up, and if you put it down, it goes down. And then it takes some time to do that, but it's just working with jacks, mm-hmm. which...
Continually adjusting.
Yep, continually adjusting, and you have another important aspect is communication. So you have crews working that are out there by the connecting plates, watching the holes move, and then you have the crew that's doing the adjusting. So they just keep working on it little by little until those holes line up, and they have the more complicated part, the erection engineer that works for Kramer does. And he does all the calculations and uses software to say, well, we need to lower the back end of the bridge 16 inches. So we're going to do that a quarter at a time in four steps. And then we're going to check each time and see where the holes line up. But it's again, it just, you know, communication, planning, plan the work the plan. And we really didn't have any problems.
It was another day where there was a lot of people that came to town to watch. There was a lot of people on the riverbank throughout the day watching this whole process, which is a relatively slow process, of course, which feels like that's part of the methodical. It needs to go slow and step by step for things to move. And so over the course of the day, you know, we slowly watched this center section get lifted in to fill the gap that we had seen for so long. And of course, as it gets to the top, it looks like it can't fit. It looks like there's no way that it can fit in there. But I think that's part of what you're talking about with these adjustments, to open things up so that it kind of slides into place and then things come back into closeness again so that everything can be tightened up and everything fits. It was an amazing day to watch again. What's it like on the ground that day, or what are you doing all day on a day like that?
Yeah, it was. I was really happy to see people show up and watch and be excited about the bridge, and it's really kind of a once in a lifetime thing. The Mississippi River bridges and other major crossing bridges, they happen across the United States, but it's pretty rare to see. First of all, it's very rare to construct a truss bridge for the highway system. Typically, you know, we will elect to go with an arch, something a little more cost efficient. Not much more, but they're slightly more cost efficient and more modern. It's a different aesthetic, but we had the opportunity to build a truss bridge, and so it's pretty common to have a center section lift due to those reasons I talked about with the navigation traffic and the efficiency of building it. So there are other examples out there, but you don't see it too often. So I'm glad this is another kind of shared experience we can all have together to see that section get lifted up in the air by, again, jacks. This is just some simple jacks with cables, and you turn the hydraulic pressure up, and then it gets lifted. And it does take a long time, which I think it took longer than people expected. But it was, there's no reason to rush it when you have an entire day to do it. You can do it safely and methodically, and then make sure that you don't have any problems as it's going up.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And it was interesting to watch because, you know, it seemed like you don't really see it moving. You know, all of a sudden it just, you realize it's a little higher than it was before. And then all of a sudden you realize, wow, it's almost way up to the top. It's right up there. So as it gets close to the top, I mean, is that, I'm always amazed, Clayton, at how you handle all of these situations, because you always come across as so calm and together. But as it gets closer, do you feel a little tingle inside, or do you get nervous, or is that plan just that solid for you that you're good?
I am very, again, thankful for the team that we have. I was the most nervous during the demolition, because they don't tell you exactly when that blast is going to happen. So we were waiting for the sirens to go off, and there was more uncertainty just because of the nature of how an explosive demolition goes. This lift I was very comfortable with, because again, it was months of planning. We had many meetings. Everybody knew where to be, what to do, and how to do it. And then really the worst thing that could happen is that we would lift it up off the barges, and then we would have to chain it off for a day and come back and continue the lift another day after we'd solved whatever problem had come up. But it was just good teamwork.
Well, it must be quite a crew. I was down along the river fairly early that morning, and I think I observed a bit of a meeting, you know, all these orange vests and hats, you know, standing around. But clearly you guys were having some conversation about getting ready for the day. Can you talk about that? It almost felt like kind of like a, you know, before a ball game or something, the team, you know, a little rally point or something. What goes on in those conversations?
Yeah, the little pep talk before the work actually starts, the huddle. So, again, a lot of it's focused on safety and protocol. So we'll get together and step through the work. It might be redundant. You may have heard this 20 times already, but the safest thing to do is still repeat it and talk through it so that everybody knows where to go, what to do, and how to do it safely. So really, we just, sometimes we call them tailgate meetings, but you're going through that work plan again and talking, making a touch point with every single person that's going to be doing something and repeating what they need to do, when, how, where, you know, all of the important information that they would need to know to be successful and to do what needs to be done.
So let's talk about the crew a little bit. Do they come from distance? I mean, are most of these guys from away, I would imagine? Tell me about who works for Kramer, I guess it is, pretty much, right?
Yeah, there's all kinds of different contractors that are working on the project. So okay. Kramer's doing the main construction. They're what we call the prime contractor. And they signed the contract with the contracting authority, which would be the state of Iowa, but they can hire subcontractors to do some of the other work. So we have Chig Fry doing the roadway, and we have other contractors out there. We've had just a huge list of people helping us out to get the bridge done successfully. And these different subcontractors come from different places. So Industrial Coatings that's doing the painting of the bridge may have some people that come from, I can't remember specific examples, but it could be as far as Alabama, different places in the South, or on the coasts. They travel the entire country doing this work, this specialized work, and they show up, they get hotel rooms in the area, stay for a while, and then go to the next project. So they're not here as long as Kramer's here typically. So these subcontractors that do specialty work will come and go, and they stay for a little bit, and then they go to the next project. Kramer has a lot of union labor from the area, and so there are a lot of local people working on the project as well. And it depends on where they actually live. Some live close enough where they commute every day. Some stay in the area, or they even rent or buy houses in Lansing and just live here.
Well, it's interesting even to watch some of the process of people, you know, workers being up either on those beams or up in these baskets that have them. How far up in the air are they?
If they're working on some of the tallest parts of the steel truss, they're about 180 feet above the water. So it's pretty high up there.
Have you been up there?
I haven't. I don't like heights, and I've worked a lot of my past experience is working on construction projects, and something the contractors and the inspection crews always talk about is, you know, there's a common phrase that it's, you know, the safest place to be is not there. So if you don't need to be out there where the work is happening, it's safer to be, you know, somewhere else.
Sure.
And so I try to avoid getting up there and getting in people's way and being in a high place with all of my protective equipment on and my harness. And then you have to have lanyards that attach to different attachment points for fall protection.
Sure.
Just to make sure if you fall that you don't fall all the way down. And Kramer really does an excellent job of, they have this extensive safety plan and they follow it, and their crews stay safe. And they have a really good focus on making sure people go home at the end of the day. So I haven't been up there. I don't know exactly what it's like, but I know our inspection staff does all the time. They're up there. We have to check the bolts that they put in, and we have to make sure they're tight. And there's a process to do that we have to be a part of. So our crew, our inspectors go up there with a massive torque wrench, and they click that torque wrench to make sure that the bolt doesn't turn under a certain amount of turning pressure or torque. So they're up there, and then they've gotten very comfortable with it throughout the project as they do it on a daily basis. But I'm sure the first time you do that, it's pretty nerve-wracking.
Yeah, I would imagine. I would imagine. That's way up there. It looks way up there when you're, you know, down on the ground or crossing on the ferry. And, you know, I guess I would imagine that there's an awful lot of bolts that went together to put together those cantilever pieces, the spans that came out. And then I suppose, is that the next piece for once that center section is lifted into place, is start bolting it all down, getting it all, you know, connected?
Yep. That's what Kramer has been working on over the last couple weeks. They've been getting all the bolts. So initially, there's the process kind of works. You put pins in the connecting plate, and these are just smooth pins that slide into the hole, and they are a little larger than the diameter or the size of the bolts that are used for the final fastening of the connection plates. And because a little bit about some of the design of structures, our holes, depending on the size of the bolt, are larger than the bolt, so that you have a little wiggle room and it's easier to construct. And that's all accounted for in the design strength of the bridge. But the bolt holes that we're working with are 1/8 of an inch larger than the bolt. But if you put pins in there that are almost the exact same diameter, that lets you line up all of those holes. And then you put so many pins in, you put, you know, 25% of the holes are filled with pins. You start putting bolts in, tightening them up. And then they work through that, again, methodically. There's a process to do it. They put the bolts in, they start taking out the pins and replacing them with bolts. And then that connecting plate is really well lined up. Mm. And they do that over and over again across the entire bridge. And that's how you get a truss.
So do we have any idea how many bolts would go into the bridge like that?
I don't have the exact number off the top of my head. We've thrown around the number 150,000. And that is just the field bolts that go in the connecting plates. So that's what the contractor's putting in now. but many of the steel members that make up the truss are bolted members, or bolted. What I mean by a bolted steel beam is that you can either weld the steel plates together to make a beam, like a box beam that makes up the top and the bottom cords of the bridge. We call we'll focus on the lower cord, which is just the bottom string of the truss that goes across the river. That is a box beam, and then instead of welding the corners of the box beam, we bolt them together, and that provides a little bit more safety, a factor of safety for the bridge, because when we look at what could happen that would endanger the structure, we look at mostly at steel beams that are being pulled apart that we call tension members, because if they were to fail, it would be a catastrophe, just snap and pull apart. So we want to make sure that in the design, there's an extra factor safety there. They're what we call redundancy. And so a box beam, if you weld it together and something cracks, that crack will go through the weld into the next steel plate and the whole beam will crack. If you make it out of bolted plates and you just take four plates and bolt them together into a box, one of those plates can crack and it will not propagate or continue into the other plates. So the bridge is actually designed for several, we call it internal redundancy. One of those plates can crack and the bridge would be just fine. Mm-hmm. And we'll find that during an inspection, during one of our regular inspections, and we can replace that plate and continue to service the bridge. The existing bridge had parts that we call fracture critical, and that just means if that part failed, it could compromise the structure, like the pins, because the original bridge did not have connecting. It had the independent span in the middle that was connected by four pins, and if something failed around there, there's no other path for the weight of the bridge to go through. So the new bridge, a lot of people have pointed out that there's no connecting, that it has connecting steel beams on the top as well as the bottom. And that's another factor of safety that we have to consider to make sure the bridge is safe and to not have those members that could fail. So it has what we call an alternate load path, where if a beam failed, the load would still go through the top of the bridge and it wouldn't fail catastrophically.
It seems like safety has just been a number one priority here, and I think that's just really important as we think about this bridge that has been such a big project for the community and so important for the long-term development of the area, and we want that bridge to last. So I'm grateful for all of those steps that are taken to make sure that it stays strong and steady for a long period of time for the people of the community. That's really awesome. So we're going to take a break again for a minute. I want to remind listeners that this is WDRT Community Radio 91.9 on your FM dial. You are welcome to tune into Conversations every Thursday morning. You can catch it live 9 a.m. on Thursday mornings, or take a look in the archive later on, or you could even stream it, wdrt.org. Glad to have you here. Hello again. This is Kayleen Welsh, and I'm here on Conversations, and my guest is Clayton Burke, the project manager for the DOT, Iowa DOT, as we are working and talking about the construction of the new bridge at Lansing. And we've been talking about what's been going on with the bridge, what the changes have been, and what's gone on since Clayton and I talked nearly a year ago. It's probably important now to spend some time talking about what's next. Right now we have this steel structure. It almost kind of looks like a skeleton, you know, across the river, but it's complete, I mean, as far as the outline. So, but where do we go next?
Right. There's been an incredible amount of work that's gone into getting this far. And I think people I'm excited that people can actually see the work going on now. At the start of the project, it was all underground, and I saw a lot of comments like, well, what are they doing? They're not making any progress. And they've been working this hard throughout the entire project. You couldn't see that work, and now it's manifesting in the steel truss, the steel skeleton, or the frame of the bridge. And you saw just how fast that went up. And now that we have the outline of the frame and the steel beams in place, the big focus is going to be on getting the concrete deck constructed on top of that steel frame. So the Kramer's doing an excellent job of finding ways to get that done as fast as possible. And so they were able to actually start. Well, I should probably start with how you build a concrete deck. So the first step is to put down plywood forms that are just sheets of plywood that we'll put the concrete on top of. And those plywood forms sit on 2x4s or 2x8s and are hung off of the steel beams so that when you put the concrete down, it sits on top of that plywood, and then we pour it a certain thickness, and that kind of varies across the bridge. You have certain spots that are higher and a little thicker, but in general it's a pretty consistent thickness across the bridge. And then after you put the plywood forms down, you put the reinforcing steel down and you tie that all together. I think, you know, everybody's pretty familiar with rebar, and in this case we're actually using stainless steel rebar. And that was part of that decision was made based on the objective to have a 100-year bridge. And so that was decided that that's what we were going to shoot for. And then the designer would look at each part of the bridge and decide, well, do we need just regular rebar or do we need stainless steel rebar to get the bridge to last that long? And it does cost more, but there's a balance between paying that cost up front and then having a product that lasts longer and you don't have to pay to replace it sooner, and what that costs over time. So it is, they found it to be more cost effective to put in the stainless rebar and have it last longer rather than replacing the deck sooner. So the next steps will be getting that stainless steel rebar put on top of the plywood forms, and then we will pour concrete on top of that. And Kramer's moving so fast, they think they'll have that ready to pour by the end of July, that first section. And we have to pour it in three different sections to load the steel frame correctly. So they're going to put concrete down on the Iowa span first, and then they'll place concrete on the Wisconsin span, because concrete's actually really heavy. And, you know, even if you're only pouring it 9 inches thick, that's a lot of weight, and a lot of what we call dead weight that doesn't change. It's always there and it sits on the structure. And then so the last pour will be from across the river, the center section of the bridge. And that'll be the largest pour. But all in all, it'll take through the end of the year to get all that concrete placed and to pour the bridge deck. And then after that, we have to put the safety railings on the bridge, which takes more time than you would think. It's kind of a surprising amount of time to build the concrete railing. And then we're getting kind of a special railing on the bridge. A lot of our standard bridges just have concrete barrier on the side and that's it. Ours is a slightly shorter section of concrete, and then we're putting a steel railing on top, and that steel railing allows you to see over the bridge more, and you can see more lancing and more of the scenery around the bridge.
That's a nice touch.
Yeah. So I was excited that we were able to do that. We're using a special crash-tested barrier that was developed by Pennsylvania DOT. Then everything we use has to follow codes, and it has to be crash-tested. So this was one of the only options we had to provide that open railing so that we could see over the bridge. But that could take a few months to get that concrete railing formed up and poured, because you can't use a machine to do that. It's all handwork. So they'll have forms that you pour the concrete inside of, and they'll pour a section, then they'll take the forms off, set them up again, pour another section, and they'll keep moving those forms across the bridge. And then they'll bring in the steel railing and tie the steel railing on top. But, you know, again, it's all handwork. It all takes time.
Well, it sounds like things keep moving, and yet would you say that we're still on target for I think the last I heard was spring 2027 potential opening? Thoughts about that?
Yeah, there's a lot of rumors going around that we'll have the bridge open at least one lane by the end of the year.
I heard that rumor.
Yeah. So I think we have to share a little bit about how a public agency looks at communicating this information. And so we have a lot of unknowns between now and spring of 2027. We could have a major flood. We could have some significant design challenge that pushes back the construction. And we don't want to set an expectation and fail to meet that expectation. Mm-hmm. So there's the best practice for us is to under-promise and over-deliver. And we're very comfortable with spring of 2027. That gives us some room for things to go wrong, and that gives us some room for weather and flooding and having a terrible winter.
Yeah, another winter to get through.
Yep, and still deliver on what we're communicating as the opening date for the new bridge. So that's pretty realistic, but we schedule-wise, we've had wonderful weather for the most part. We are staying on schedule for the schedule that we developed after the change to demolition first. So we are still marching right along for spring of 2027.
Well, and I think it's been impressive just to see the different crews kind of in action. You know, I know they're working on the approaches at the same time as this is happening for the bridge and the center sections being built. There's different pieces happening all at the same time.
Yeah. And one thing we haven't talked about is the roadway work. Mm-hmm. But there's this entire multi-million dollar roadway going in next to the bridge so that we can connect that bridge to the rest of the highway system. And Chick Fry's been doing that out of Dubuque, and they have been doing an excellent job. We haven't really had any major issues. They've just been doing all the grading, the roadway work, the prep. They've been pouring concrete. So if you drive by, you can actually see that the shape that new roadway is taking, and it will be slightly higher than the old roadway. And it moves slightly to the west to provide a wider intersection, so it's easier for commercial motor vehicles to get through that area. And it's got some really nice curb and gutter and designs and aesthetics, so it looks... Chick-fil-A is doing an awesome job putting that together, and it's starting to look really nice.
It sounds like that's another piece that got a little bit of attention as far as, aesthetics, as far as it looking nice and being a nice-looking approach to the bridge.
Yep.
We're lucky that way. How has that gotten to happen?
It has a lot to do with we use... Well, obviously, again, there's that customer focus from the DOT. We want to provide something that looks good, it supports the community and the local area, and we don't just build these ugly square or rectangular concrete structures and then say we don't care what it looks like. You know, we actually care about what our facilities and how our customers interact with those facilities, what they look like. And then there's also, if we're using federal funds, I believe, I could be wrong about this, but I believe that there's a requirement that we use a certain percentage of those federal funds to go towards aesthetics.
Nice. Okay. Yeah. All right. All right. Well, I guess it seems like what else? I mean, those are the pieces that are going to need to be finished. It feels like it's important to just kind of maybe go over and let people know what this new bridge is offering that the old one didn't. I mean, it's significantly wider, for one thing. Can you speak to some of the benefits of this new bridge?
Right. The big focus on the reconstruction project was to update the bridge to modern standards. So the existing bridge was only 21 feet wide, and it was a structure that was built in the late 20s, early 30s, and it met, you know, all the safety standards of that time. But now we've developed new, we have larger vehicles, and we have new standards that all of our structures have to meet. So we're making it wider and providing full shoulders in case there's an emergency on the bridge. There's now room to pull off. Or if there's a wider vehicle that needs to use the bridge, they can use those shoulders and not crowd the opposite direction.
Sure, like the farm equipment occasionally or something like that that crosses the bridge.
Exactly. So it's safer in that aspect. And then the intersection on the Iowa side was a very tight T intersection, and it was a challenge for semis to get around. So now we're widening that and making it bigger. So again, safer, easier to use for our customers. And then we're also making the navigation channel under the bridge wider. One big issue that the bridge has had throughout its history is being hit by barges. And so now we're moving that pier further away from what they use, and it'll be safer for navigation traffic.
Well, it's going to be a great addition to the city of Lansing and, you know, cross for the towns and Wisconsin on the other side. I mean, it's a great bridge to build this community around, and I'm grateful for everything that's gone on. And I know we're about out of time, so I thought we should just probably take a minute and let people know about ferry hours and stuff as we come into the 4th of July. Is it on a holiday schedule for July 4th on that Saturday? Do you know?
Yep. On July 4th, the ferry will run from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. The last trip leaves Iowa at about 6:45. Okay. So if you show up at 7 o'clock on the Wisconsin side, they're already going to be shut down.
Okay. All right. Good to know. And, you know, because I think the holidays, that's when we do see a little more traffic on the ferry. People are maybe needing to be prepared for a little bit of a wait. It's hard to know exactly what you will experience on a holiday like that, or weekends. They've gotten busier. But overall, things are moving pretty clearly or smoothly, and things are going well as far as the ferry goes and all of that. And I hope that the traffic, that people continue to come over to Lansing, ride the ferry across, get an experience. There's a lot of good things happening in Lansing. So grateful for the ferry and its efforts to keep people moving, to keep Lansing alive. Lansing's a sweet little town that we want to see continue to thrive and flourish. And so I guess I'll just encourage people to come on over. You know, check out the town. There's some, you know, great restaurants, activities, things to keep informed of, and a system, an app apparently that you can get that you can get notices about what's happening with the ferry.
Yep. Iowa and Wisconsin both have the 511 app, and our Pete Helmstead, our social media manager, has put out information on how to sign up for notifications through the 511 app.
Awesome. So people can keep informed and be aware of what's happening. And I just appreciate you coming in, Clayton, and sharing all this information. And I appreciate the work that you and your team have done to make this such a positive experience for the city of Lansing. I mean, it's a difficult thing to have happen, to lose the bridge that we had, and yet to have it come back together as in the way that it has really been a very positive experience, I think, overall.
Absolutely. I appreciate the opportunity to come here and share the experience we've been having. And I my favorite part of this, all of this, is connecting with the community. So I love this. I love sharing the project, and I hope people feel connected to the bridge just like they did with the Blackhawk Bridge.
Yeah, very much. Thanks a lot.